Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
And I'm Jordan Crook.
And we are joined once again by our colleague in Taiwan, Catherine Xu. Welcome back, Catherine.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And we're excited to have you back to talk about Always Be My Maybe, the new romantic comedy on Netflix. But before we do that, I think Jordan just has general excitement to share with the world.
Yeah, I'm hype. I'm hype because it's the new, there's so much new TV coming out, you guys. I don't know if there's stuff on this list that you're particularly interested in. I mean, we got three new episodes of Handmaid's Tale that came out on Wednesday, as well as three episodes of Black Mirror. I have to say, a little bit peeved that something like Bandersnatch took away actual episodes of Black Mirror from me. That's the way I'm looking at it. Three episodes is not a season make.
Although, to be fair, I mean, the original seasons of Black Mirror were also three episodes each.
Were they? I thought they were like six.
The seasons one and two were three episodes. And then once it moved to Netflix, the seasons got longer.
Did you feel that there was like a difference in quality between like the earlier earlier seasons where they focus on the three episodes and then in the kind of later ones was it like five or six? It was definitely longer.
They would usually do, I think, six.
Yeah.
Maybe even more than that. I can't remember.
I think they range in quality in general because that's how an anthology series works. Like,
right.
You know, so generally speaking, I think they do. I think that I watched all three episodes of the new season and we will talk about it, but I will say that like, tone-wise, it feels a little different this season. At least two out of the three episodes to me felt very like tonally different from Black Mirror. That's not to say it's not, you don't know you're watching Black Mirror because you do, but anyways, we'll save all that up. So Black Mirror is one that's new. We've got, this is kind of lame. This is like goes into my like trash bin collection of television, but Designated Survivor, new Designated Survivor today, folks, season three. So that's exciting. I don't know if you guys dabbled in Designated Survivor at all.
No.
I do know that, I mean, it recently moved onto, became a Netflix original because it was canceled by the network and then Netflix revived it.
It was the right play because I always had like a mild interest in, like apocalypse / political dramas, two of my sweet spots television wise. So this felt very like right in my lane, but it was the right choice to go to Netflix because I never actually committed to it or like doubled down on it until two full seasons were available on Netflix. And then I was like, oh, this is a solid like 30 hours of television for me to just waste my life with. So that's what I did. And I think that it's completely far-fetched and stupid, a lot of bad acting, but still just completely addictive and entertaining. So that's one to look for. And there's plenty to watch. And then let's see, Big Little Lies on Sunday. That's exciting. I believe there's a new episode again, Trash Bin, So You Think You Can Dance is coming back.
Do you feel like there's a lot of new stuff coming out now, or do you feel like also it was that for you and probably for a lot of people, Game of Thrones just sort of sucked up so much of your attention that you weren't necessarily interested in hearing about a bunch of new TV for those 6 weeks?
Maybe, but also I feel I wanted to bring this up. I was thinking it and I haven't decided if I actually like am convicted in this thought or it was just like a fleeting thought that I had. But like it's possible Game of Thrones ruined like all TV, not just its own show. I don't know, because the way that I feel now after like when I watch new TV other than Game of Thrones is that like it's either wildly predictable or shocking for the sake of shocking, and I can't find anything that is like one layer below exactly what you'd predict would happen, and I'm kind of bummed out about that. I'm hoping that like some of these hard hitters, because we have Big Little Lies and Succession coming up. Succession's still a ways off. It's August, but like I have to get hyped for that because could be like the ultimate Game of Thrones replacement, not for the fantasy buffs, but for like the dialogue diehards. Wow. Alliterative right. On a Friday morning. but like, you know, some of those I hope will bring a little spice to them and something that goes like layers deeper than what you see and expect. But I don't know. I maybe Game of Thrones distracted me a little bit, but you know, I kind of keep on top of TV. I think it just happens to be that there are a handful of shows that are like shows I love that are all at once. Big Little Lies, Designated Survivor, and Handmaid's Tale and Black Mirror, all four in 1 week, are all four shows that I love. So like, it's just a good week. It's a good week to be Jordan. Yeah. And if you're into any of those shows, it's a good week for you too. And I'll say it's always great when your shows come out in the summer, because in the summer, particularly in New York, this is probably different from for our like San Francisco listeners and stuff, but in New York, like in the winter, it's hibernation time and like nobody wants to really go out or do anything, particularly me, because I generally don't want to go out and do anything anyway. But then in the summer, it's like you don't really have an excuse. So you have to go and do things. So this way you can like kind of backlog, you know, you don't run out of TV in the summer because there's a bunch of stuff to go out in the world and do. And then you come back and you're like, oh, I still have a bunch of new episodes of this. You know, it's great.
Yeah, it's funny.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just thinking it's funny that you mentioned Game of Thrones taking up so much of your attention, because I haven't watched the show in 4 or 5 years. I just tapped out after, I think, season 3 or 4. But I also feel like it's taken up a lot of my attention just because of like all the discussion about it and analysis and then the meta-analysis. It's just, it also just the fact that it was like such a long running show that so many people became invested in and everything there was in it to say about gender and, you know, the disappointments around the ending. I also feel like I didn't even watch the show, like the final season. I feel like I have Game of Thrones fatigue too.
There were a few years where, basically for season 3, I think, I kind of fell behind and wasn't keeping up because I didn't have an HBO subscription at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember I definitely felt like I was still watching it because even back then, it was, there was just so much discussion around it. And then, yeah. You know, since then, I've obviously caught up. But the discussion around it has intensified so much that I definitely feel like almost anyone you talk about, except perhaps our colleague Brian Heater, who makes a point of, I think, avoiding any possible discussion of Game of Thrones because he just doesn't care.
He doesn't even avoid it. Like, he like trolls. It's like it's an attention move. He's like, oh, I hate Game of Thrones. I will poke at you guys and get you to yell at me about Game of Thrones. It's just for fun for him, man.
I try not to care about it, but I'm still like emotionally invested in it. I mean, it was actually, I'm just thinking about the one scene. When Sansa was raped by Ramsay Bolton. I just remember, I didn't even watch that episode. I just read about it. I was just like, oh no, I can't handle it anymore. And I tried to detach myself from the show because, I mean, there was just a lot of stuff in it, which I found really disturbing in content and also the way it was handled, you know, handled the show, handled versus the books. But then I, you know, honestly, like when it ended and when I read about the ending and, you know, I watched clips online, I realized I'm so very emotionally invested in a show that I haven't watched in 5 or 6 years, you know?
Yeah, seriously, fuck Game of Thrones.
How dare they?
I'm so mad.
I also do think too soon. One thing that happened was that certainly if you're a show like Handmaid's Tale, where you probably, you know, want people to sort of be talking about it and the recaps and all of that. And there's probably some level of, I mean, maybe they were never gonna launch on those dates anyway, but I think that any show that wants to be a part of that cultural conversation, you know, you probably got to get the hell out of the Game of Thrones 6-week window because you're just going to get completely trampled.
It's funny you mention that because Handmaid's Tale is supposed to come out in April. The last 2 years that came out in April. Okay. I think it was like maybe April the first year and May the second year, but like it was earlier than this. They clearly, I think a lot of shows did. I can't like match up the other ones I mentioned to their dates, mostly because like particularly with Netflix stuff, they're like, well, it's whatever. I think that's part of why we're getting so much good TV all at once is they were like, let's just wait. We'll release everything like the second week of June. And I was here on the second week of June, like, yeah, clapping. So that's what's up.
It worked.
Yeah, everything's good. There's new TV afoot. We're going to talk about all of it, whether my co-hosts like it or not. And I guess we can get into Always Be My Baby.
Yeah, let's do it. So it is starring and written by Randall Park and Ali Wong, who we talked about last week because of Tuca and Birdie. And then it's directed by Ninochka Khan, who is the showrunner on Fresh Off the Boat, which Randall Park is on. But then I think a lot of the excitement really was around sort of Randall Park, Ali Wong, romantic comedy that, you know, it's going to put these two Asian American comedians front and center, which you just sort of never see.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's actually funny because I haven't, this is the first Ali Wong thing I've actually seen, which what? I mean, it's kind of like, it always surprises people when they hear that because it seems like something they'd be really, I know. But actually the thing is like when her first big comedy special came out on Netflix, I was pregnant. And okay. I was just like, I did not want any pregnancy content in any of the TV shows I watch. I was like, and that's why I mean, the thing is like, I guess every single show would have like a pregnancy reference in it. And I was just like, I can't look at another pregnant woman. I can't look at myself. I just can't. So, so basically it really just got to the point where like, yeah, that finally I read the reviews of the show and I was just like, it sounds like it's going to be something that's really, yeah, like Anthony said, groundbreaking for representation of Asian Americans. And also it just sounds like it's just going to be funny. So now I have a lot of like Ali Wong backlog to catch up on.
You should definitely watch. So I have seen all of her stand up and Hard Knock Wife. That's the first one, right? Baby Cobra comes after.
Yeah.
So Baby Cobra is the initial one. And that came out in 2016. And that's the one where I think everyone kind of like sat up and took notice. I was like, holy shit, this Ali Wong person is amazing. And then Hard Knock Wife came out last year.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so Hard Knock Wife is the one that I wasn't as like enamored with. It's still good and stuff. But like Baby Cobra, there are some lines in Baby Cobra that like still to this day like ring in my ears. There's one joke where she's talking about Sheryl Sandberg's book about leaning in. And she keeps talking about how she like married this guy who was like Harvard educated so that she could just stop working. And she's like, I don't want to lean in. I want to lie down. And I just, that to me was one of the best lines of all time. She's so funny and so great. And this, I think, Always Be My Baby is no exception. Just really funny. It almost like, maybe I'm off base on this, but it felt like somewhat wholesome for like a 2019 rom-com. Like there was nothing in it where I would be, if I was sitting there watching next to my mom and dad. I mean, I might not be as fresh on this. I watched it a couple nights ago, but I'm pretty sure there's nothing in it where if I was sitting next to my mom and dad and my grandma watching this movie that I would like cringe. You know what I mean? Like there are a couple things, you know, there's curse words and stuff like that. There's nothing where you're like, oh God, you know, it like feels very wholesome for everyone kind of movie, you know?
Particularly compared to her stand-up, where, like, in her stand-up, I mean, she talks a lot about her body versus here, like, the most sort of body humor you get is, like, stuff about farts. Like, it's not that intense.
Yeah, I was actually really surprised by that because I had, you know, when I was describing it to my husband, I said, oh, it's a raunchy sex comedy with two Asian American leads. And I was just like, I've waited my entire life to say that phrase. But then I actually watched it and I was just like, oh, this is, I mean, I liked it a lot, but I was just like, this is a lot less raunchy than what I had expected based on, you know, what I had heard about Ali Wong's, you know, sense of humor and her jokes. And it was actually really, yeah, I was like, it's like you guys said, it was actually very wholesome and heartwarming and actually very sweet.
I appreciate that because it was no less funny. You know what I mean? Yeah, I feel like rom-coms have kind of lost that like 90s magic where we're all just completely satisfied by like a few jokes and like two pretty people and like they make it in the end despite all the odds, right? Like that like kind of stopped being enough for some reason. And then all of a sudden all of these rom-coms, one, have like gone way down in quality. I don't think there's been a good rom-com in a long time. We've talked about a couple Netflix originals that were pretty good, but you know, that kind of went away and instead it became like more like you said, like a raunchy sex comedy as opposed to a rom-com. Mm-hmm. And like so much like vulgarity used in that for like shock laughs. I'm not saying I haven't laughed along in them and stuff, and it's fine. It's like its own little genre and stuff. But I liked that this felt like, you know, a 90s, early 2000s rom-com in a lot of ways. It didn't rely on like gross jokes to be funny. It was just really smart, you know, and really funny on its own. And I will say it felt a little bit like some of those amazing sitcoms like 30 Rock and The Office, where you're laughing over jokes and you realize you missed one because they're just one after the other, after the other, after the other. And if you let out a laugh too loud, you're going to miss one kind of thing. So
and I, I just watched it for the second time today, just before this podcast. I was just like, whoa, there's so much in here that I miss. Because I feel like it reminds me of writing on shows like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, where it's just so fast paced. Like basically almost everything they say is like a joke or a gag. Some of it's more subtle and character based. But the thing is, it's really, there's just so much. I mean, I feel like, you know, when people hear romantic comedy, think of something, you know, just light, kind of easy. But it's just like the pacing is very fast. And just, there's just, like Jordan said, there's just so much in it that I think it's like definitely worth a second watch.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the script I was less crazy about, that I think there are some good jokes, but there are also some jokes where as soon as you hear the setup, you can immediately guess what the punchline is. So I was sort of like, it, like intellectually, I was like, I don't think this is that funny. And then the person, like someone I was watching it with was like, yeah, but you keep laughing. And I realized that what it was for me was, it was a lot more about the delivery and how there was just like you're talking about that pace and the way someone would say something insane. And then like, you would just have like 1 second of reaction and then they would immediately move on. And there was something about just the rhythm and the acting that made stuff funny, even when I didn't think the joke as a joke was that great.
Yeah. And a lot of like character, the you look at the kind of like format and structure, like if you strip it all down to its bare bones, you've got like kind of this deadbeat guy who suffered a trauma. You've got this chef, right? Like how many women chefs are in like rom-coms? Like they're all women chefs for some reason, right? Like they're all, it's like all this very archetypal stuff that felt like it had a perfectly unique spin on it, where I didn't feel like I was watching something formulaic at all because everything was unique and different, right? So like he's in a band and you expect this to be a band, right? Like a rock band where they're like playing and singing like moody songs, and he gets up there and he's like rapping this like very like ironic kind of like humorous, not so serious but kind of serious thing, and it's really good and cool and unique, and you're like, it's not the kind of thing where throughout the movie she keeps saying like, you could make it, your band could make it if you just tried and like applied yourself, you know? And it's not one of those things where like she says it and so it's true. It's like, I actually was like, yeah, I'd listen to that on Spotify, you know? Like I could like this song. So I think like,
that's interesting. I don't think his band is going to be successful, and I think that's okay.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, I that's fine if it's not successful. I guess the point is that they did a good enough job with little details instead of just being like, this is so, and you should believe it because it is so. Mm-hmm. I think they put a little extra work into it to say like, she's not just a chef because she's the chef. They show her learning about cooking. They show her cooking. They show her like kind of attitude in these restaurants, and it doesn't feel so cookie cutter, in my opinion. It felt like a little bit better than just like putting a stamp on it and calling it something, you know?
I agree that there was like this, I felt like there's sort of this template that the movie kind of falls into in some ways. And in some ways, I think that's fine. I think there were some times where I was a little dissatisfied, where it felt a little too formulaic to me. But that in key moments, I think throughout the movie, they like, because the characters are well enough done and the acting and like everything is good enough, that I enjoyed it. Even when I was kind of like, oh, I see where this is going. Like, I don't necessarily think this is like that groundbreaking in certain scenes. And then I think where it ends up, and I think where I could sort of say this without sort of spoiling anything, is that there's sort of this arc that I was worried that they were going to take the characters on, and it didn't go in that direction. And so I was mostly happy with, you know, where the two characters, I mean, not a shocker, they end up together at the end, and what they had to do to end up together, I thought was really well done.
I want to know more once we get into spoiler area about the arc you thought they were going to take.
Yeah.
What were you going to say, Catherine? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, yeah, definitely there was a part I should say before the spoiler section, there was a part where I was just like, oh, great. You know, it's just like this is getting to a part where I could like, you know, it's kind of started to follow like a template. But then I thought the ending was pretty satisfying. I know I was looking, just kind of like skimming through some reviews. I knew people were like, yeah, it was an okay film. It had good jokes in it. But actually, I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought it would. I would, considering that I don't usually like romantic comedies. And I don't think I'm just saying that because it had two Asian American leads. And, you know, I'm invested in that.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was great. And didn't Ali Wong co-write it as well? Or is it just Randall?
Yeah, the two of them, so they're basically three writers. I think what happened was basically she and Randall wrote the initial script together, and then they probably brought in this third writer to do, you know, another draft of it. But yeah, it's basically their script.
Yeah, it's actually very, there was that New York Magazine interview with Randall Park that I sent to you, Anthony. It's I was surprised at how autobiographical, well, not totally autobiographical, but there was a lot in Marcus that was based on Randall Park's, his childhood in his early 20s. I thought that was very interesting because I hadn't really actually known that much about him in his personal life before.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I mean, I thought that what they did with his arc, like, was pretty well done because you learn very quickly that, I don't think this is much of a spoiler, that he has a fear of succeeding, right? Which is like different from, I mean, I guess it's tied up one, like hand in hand with a fear of failure, right? But like trying and failing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really, you know, they use the line in the movie, which is so super, super cliche, which, you know, at some point you're going to have to take a chance on something, right? And you hear that all the time, and that's super cliche and rote. But I think the way that they portrayed him and his kind of fear of trying, like fear of caring and going after something, is like really poignant. And it's not like a super common, you know, quote, problem that is introduced, I think, in shows and TV and stuff like that. So I thought they did a good job with that. I think it's something super, super relatable. I think it's like more of a prevalent issue than people want to talk about. It's just like, I don't want to try because I would hate to fail, you know, but I think we all struggle with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I've definitely, when I went to therapy, talked to my therapist about. I found it very relatable.
I thought, you know what it reminded me of, you know, do you remember, did you guys watch Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe, you know, like Kumar's basically TV.
Oh yeah. It was, well, I watched it when it first came out, and that was when I was in my early 20s. So, you know, I had a lot of anxiety about, on the one, I just really kind of just wanted to like hang out and do my own thing. But at the same time, I also felt like I was still at this point where I felt like I had to tick all these boxes of what I consider success, like, you know, going to grad school and saying, you know, hitting these like different career goals. And then there's a part where Kumar is like, he's like a stereotypical slacker character at first, you know, he smokes a lot of weed, obviously. But he's actually, you know, he's a really talented doctor. And at one point while he's like applying to medical school, he tells the dean, like, he's like, well, you know, just because you're hung like a horse doesn't mean you have to be a porn star, you know? But then it's revealed later on in the movie that he actually really does want to go to medical school and study. I think he was also just scared of failure. So I think it's, yeah, it was just like, that really resonated with me in my early 20s. And I think it's, maybe it still resonates a bit with me, but I've just kind of, I'm okay with being a failure now. So it's like maybe not so much.
Being a failure would be a success at this point for me. So I'm just like, all right, might as well try.
I'm just like, you know, being a failure means just kind of hanging out home, chilling out, doing my own thing. I'm like, well, that doesn't sound bad. You know?
It's not to like, to be clear to our listeners, like, we're not like shaming those whose ambitions aren't through the roof, right? Like,
yeah, because that's kind of like the person. Well, I feel like, you know, I feel like I've always wanted to be that kind of person, but just like, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I felt bad about that. So, yeah, so it's like, it's like you said, Jordan, it's like that aspect of Marcus's character, I did find very relatable, especially since a lot of it's for him, it's like being at home, being with his dad, kind of feeling safe and also kind of needed there, you know, because he's he does kind of help his dad do his insulin shots, and he works with his dad. And I found their relationship in general just, I liked the way it was portrayed a lot. But I think there's there's definitely a lot in Marcus. I think that would resonate with a lot of people who are like in their late 20s, maybe 30s, you know, who are kind of like dealing with this issues.
Or possibly even later. I don't know.
Yeah.
Forever.
Until you figure it out, you're still dealing with it. But, and I think Ali Wong's character was really great too. I mean, there was something super direct and self-aware about her, right? Like I can't really think of a situation. She had her shit together. You know, she might have been making bad choices in the love department, but generally she knew who she was. She knew what she was about, and she was really direct with everyone around her about that. And that's like a nice, refreshing thing. Like, our female lead was like generally awesome. You know what I mean? It's normally like they've got some fatal flaw that makes them so blind to everything around them, you know? And with her, we just had like a strong, very put together, successful person who knows what she's about, is going for it. You know what I mean? Like,
that really struck me, you know, during her break. Well, is this a spoiler?
We could get into spoilers. I think we're around that time, right? So,
yeah, let's just say we're going to, you know, in general, obviously, I mean, I think some of us maybe had some reservations, but in general, we liked Always Be My Maybe. If you haven't seen it yet, you should watch it. If you don't want to be spoiled for the movie, you should stop listening now.
It's a great one. Watch it. Go, Catherine.
Oh, yeah. Her breakup speech with Brendan Choi. It's like, you know, she screams like, I can't believe I wasted my prime reproductive years on you. So you realize like it's been like a long-term relationship and, you know, they were planning to get married. And then, you know, but then when she breaks up with him, she's disappointed that he wants to go take a relationship sabbatical and go to India. But at the same time, like once she's like, I can't, like, you know, she kind of gives this like really foul mouth speech at, you know, her little like cousin's birthday party. And she kind of ends it very decisively. And I was just like, that's really cool. Because the thing is like, you don't really necessarily see a lot of scenes where a woman who's invests a lot of time and energy in a relationship is finally just at the point where they're like, you know what, I'm splitting from you. It's going to be a clean break and I'm going to go date and maybe even have a baby by myself. You know, it's like, she just really went for it.
I think that if you watch the trailer, the way that scene plays out is slightly different. He says, I don't want to get married, that he initiates that final step in the breakup more than he does. And so it seems like the scene they use, I don't know if they just shot multiple scenes or if they went and reshot it later, but that they at some point decided that she had to be much more proactive, which I think was totally the correct choice.
Yeah. And I think even in her conversations with like Marcus, there's one early on in the movie, after when they're at the Burger King or whatever. And you know, he has just gone through a big loss and he's being a dick. And she's like, you're being a fucking dick, dude. You know, it's not like she doesn't baby him. She's been super supportive of him and there for him. It doesn't change how much she loves him or how much she supports him. But in that moment, he crossed the line and she said so. You know, it's not like that's her personality, right? Is to like stand up for herself and take care of herself. And a lot of that is baked into her own childhood, right? With her parents not being around as much. And then there's a second conversation when she essentially tells him like to grow up, you know, but even for him, even for like Marcus, and again, still supporting him, like buying all of his gear and stuff for his band, still like from the background being there for him and loving him. But she tells him how it is, like, you got to get your shit together, bro, grow up, be a man, go for something, stop being a coward, you know, and just walks away from it. And I just liked that about her character. There's no negotiations. Do you know what I mean? It's all out on the table. Here are my cards. I'm going to play them. You do what you're going to do. You know what I mean? And I liked that.
There was one.
Right.
Yeah. There was one scene I noticed today. Well, like I hadn't really noticed that much before when I was watching the first time, but you know, it's like after Brandon tells her that he's going on his relationship sabbatical to India, she's, you know, just telling like her friend Monique and, you know, she's kind of putting the best spin on it. And then she walks into the walk-in freezer in a restaurant and she just starts crying. And she's interrupted by one of her chefs walking in, like looking for the oyster sauce. And she hands it to him and she's just like, you know, don't ever fall in love, Enrique. I'll just break your heart. He's like, thanks, boss. But, you know, it's like, I like that she had that
one of the funniest lines when he said, yeah. Thanks, boss. I thought that was so funny. He was like so awkward. Yeah. It wasn't thanks, boss. It was thank you, chef.
Yeah. Like, and
right, thank you, chef.
Yeah.
Super formal.
And he walks off with his like giant bit of oyster sauce. Yeah.
Oh my God. But I will say my one caveat on all the praises I'm singing is that Ali Wong's fantastic, but don't make that girl cry. It was just not, it wasn't great crying scenes in my opinion.
Because you think the performance,
yeah,
she's
performance
not like a great
wise, like
crier.
I don't think, yeah, like she's really strong, powerful. She's got like even her like warmth when she's like doing like lovier scenes was really sweet, and everything was amazing. Obviously, comedic genius, but I just don't think that. Maybe it's just a practice thing. I don't know how much of all of that she's done, but it just, I was like, oh, Ali Wong, you're not a great on-screen crier.
Like, I just felt that's that true. I mean, I will draw a line though between like there that scene you're talking about where she confronts Marcus and I mean, I think there's a couple scenes that are kind of like, but specifically the one I'm thinking about is where she's standing in front of the car, she's about to go to her restaurant opening, and she just kind of lays it all out on the line, and she's incredibly vulnerable in that moment, and I think in that scene she actually gives a really good performance. I think it's the stuff where she has to do this sort of more standard sort of crying stuff that isn't terrible, but it's not great.
I completely agree. Like that whole scene was great. And then she closes the door of the car and starts crying. And I was like, oh, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, like I just wish that final touch was just a bit better, but everything leading up, all the dialogue was perfect. Like I was about to cry. And then she started crying.
That
kind of took away my tears.
She's like, she says to him, she's like, you're the one I want to be with, even when you're being an asshole. And for some reason, I was just like, that really moved me. Like, I did also feel like a little bit teary eyed. And I thought, like, you know, if my husband and I were getting married now, I would want to write that into our vows. I'm not sure he would feel about it. But for some reason, I was just like, that is just the sweetest thing. Like, you're the person I want to be with, even when you're being an asshole. You know, I'm just like, oh, man.
And when she called him a coward, too, yeah. That was like in my throat as she said it. You know, the second he was like, I don't want to go to New York. It's a fucking coward. And she was like, you're a coward. And I was like, yeah, fucking scaredy cat. You know, like it was just, it was good. It all felt like natural and real and like true to the characters. But we have to talk about Keanu Reeves, right? Like at some
point. Oh my God. That's so good. Yeah.
I laughed. The hardest laugh in the whole movie for me was when they're at the restaurant, which is just an amazing sequence. Amazing, amazing sequence of them eating at a very, very fancy restaurant with, you know, clear asparagus broth and essence of Caesar salad and like just the monochromatic
taste of Caesar salad.
Yeah, the taste of Caesar salad and a monochromatic course as well, which is just black stuff on the, I don't even know what it was, noodles
and
oysters.
Headphones.
Yeah, the headphones. That was my favorite thing.
That's the one that got me. It starts with Keanu being like, do you have any dishes that play with the concept of time? Which in and of itself is like the most douchebag thing that could ever happen. But then he goes on to say like, yeah, you can listen to this, like whatever it is, deer as it was being killed, or like the noise of the actual deer you're eating. And he is sitting there listening to it. He takes a slow bite and just starts crying into his wine. And I could not stop laughing. That scene of him just bursting into tears saying, I'm sorry. Oh God.
I totally lost my shit at that too. It was so good.
Oh,
well, I think that scene is also a good example of the humor and what works about the humor, in the sense that when I was like, oh, they're going to do a scene that makes fun of fancy restaurants, I'm like, I've seen this scene like a million times, but because the specific jokes that they wrote for the food and what they had Keanu do were so good that it like totally won me over, even though I was like, oh, this is such a familiar scene and I think I know where this is going.
Well, and they set the table perfectly, right? Like those four people at that restaurant, because like Keanu's like the ultimate douche, right? Like eats at this restaurant every night and like wants to be, you know, a douche about it. There's no other word for it. And then you have Ali Wong, who's like obviously comes from this world, but has also, you know, sides with Marcus kind of inherently, right? And Marcus is a total detractor for this. He's like, I don't want to be a part of this. This is bullshit. He's in a like red prom tux. he can't seem to dress right the whole movie, which is just a funny little thing that they use, like a funny tool of like him not being able to figure out the wardrobe at like any event. And then his kind of ditzy girlfriend who is fawning over Keanu and trying to look fancy, like she belongs in this place. And the, like the four of them plus the waiter and those interactions was just like it puts all the right pieces on the map, you know, in a way, to make some of those jokes really stand out, because it's not just the joke itself, it's a lot of times it was Marcus's reaction to things compared to Keanu's. You see Marcus with the headphones on being like, what the fuck is this? And then you see Keanu just bursting into tears screaming out, I'm sorry. And then you see Ali Wong stuffing her face. She could care less about the sounds in her ears. She's just like, this is delicious, I'm gonna eat it. So
Marcus's girlfriend too was also really, I just loved like the gag where every time Keanu says something to her, just like more and more tears flooding down her face, but you never actually hear her cry. So it's just like a waterfall.
And the like awkwardness between Marcus and his girlfriend just generally throughout, it was like one of those cringy laughs where you're just like, oh my god, he must be so embarrassed of her.
Well, and it captures just sort of the general awkward social dynamics of double dates, or at least the double dates that I've been on, where, you know, it's not to say that anyone is being an asshole, but like, there's this sort of performative aspect of being a couple in that context. And so like, you're always trying to be like, oh, if this couple is like this, I guess we should be like this too. And then, you know, taking that to 100 when the other guy is Keanu Reeves.
Well, and I thought that the Marcus's girlfriend was like a perfect like opposite to Ali Wong in a lot of ways, because Ali Wong's character is so self-aware, like not just self-aware, but just generally aware of all the people around her and how they are and what they're up to. And the other girl was just like completely the opposite, like the least self-aware human being on the planet. She's trying to cook for a world famous chef, like rice and hot dogs. It's just like a bizarre thing to do for anyone, right? And like,
and she has her Paula Deen plates. Yeah, and Sasha's like, did you know Paula Deen, the racist butter lady?
Right, and then she's like, yeah, that's why I stole them. So it's interesting that you, though, and I think that some of the people I was watching that dinner scene with, kind of, we had kind of these similarly diverging reactions, where I think partly because I just like Keanu so much, and then also because I have this general attitude of like, when in Rome, you just sort of go with whatever the flow is. So that I definitely thought by the end of that whole, that those multiple scenes together, like Keanu is an asshole, but especially initially when he was just like, do you have any dishes that play with the concept of time? I was like, yeah, that does sound like a fun dinner. And so that in a lot of ways, Marcus came off as like such an asshole and such a spoil sport in those scenes that I kind of struggled with it. And I think to an extent that was probably just my own personal reaction, that I just like really didn't, you know, like the way he was being such a dick about some of this stuff. But in some ways, it actually tied into what I really liked about the ending, which is that I was worried that it was going to be like she had to give up some of her career. She had to learn to be less careerist. Mm-hmm. She had to learn how to cut loose. But for the most part, actually, her character didn't have to learn anything. I mean, she had to sort of open up and let him in. But besides that, it was like, no, like, you go for it. Like, you should absolutely have everything that you want. And he was the one who really had to sort of get over his bullshit. And I think, like, usually, right, in a romantic comedy, it's much more like, oh, like, she, you know, the slob has to like get a little bit more put together, and you know, the uptight woman has to like learn how to cut loose. But there was relatively little of that, and I was really happy that they didn't take it in that direction.
Yeah, me too.
There was a part like, you know, it was the part where the movie starts to get a bit formulaic, where they kind of show like them kind of moving out of the honeymoon phase and into just the, you know, this is what frustrates you about me. Frustrates me about you phase. And it kind of shows him just being, you know, not really that good of a boyfriend. He's not supportive. He kind of puts down everything that she's really into. She gets excited about something. He's just like, gross, I don't want to eat that. You know, and then they have that fight about like what authentic Asian food is, which I thought was really funny, because like every, I feel like every like Asian American couple I know has had that fight. Yeah, and then so I was like watching. I was just like, oh, you know, he's not being such a great boyfriend right now. Like, how's this going to turn out? And yeah, when he's finally like, you know, I want to be the man who's next to you holding your purse. I was just like, oh, this is like, it's actually, yeah, it's like Anthony said, it's actually, it feels really refreshing, because in a lot of romantic comedies, even if it's not supposed to be a compromise, the woman is kind of maybe adjusting, you know, the framework of her goals or her life for the man. I mean, most obvious example, because I was just thinking about Asian American films, is Crazy Rich Asians. I mean, I personally didn't like that film. I think one of the fun things about Always Be My Maybe coming out was hearing like how many of my friends actually didn't like that film that much either. But one of the things, I didn't read the books. One of the things that frustrated me about the movie was that, like, it's basically the main character, Constance Wu, she like gives up, she has like a job, like as an economics professor at, what was it, NYU? And she gives that all up to move into like, you know, a place that didn't seem very welcoming or appealing. That actually like seemed like a huge sacrifice to me, like way more than.
Well, it's not clear that she gives up her job, is it?
No. Yeah. No, I don't think she gives, she doesn't give up her job. She
no. Okay.
Yeah. The film ends on an engagement party in Singapore, but I don't think they ever say like, oh, we're gonna live here now and you can't have a job.
She's okay. Going back to the States. Yeah. She's going back to the States and he's coming back to the States. That's I mean, I think there's a lot of things to criticize about the film, which, I mean, to be fair, I love Crazy Rich Asians and frankly I enjoyed it much. I think it's a much better film than Always Be My Maybe. But I think, like, yeah, I think in terms of like the handling of the Constance Wu character, there are other, that it takes her out of this context, right? And it puts her in this other context. But she keeps her job, and in a lot of ways, in sort of maybe artificial and kind of not particularly convincing ways, it like still allows her to show that strength in the end.
Yeah, whereas like the character of Sasha doesn't move, obviously she's like moving towards her own goals, but like it's very like he has to come to her. There's no compromise in this movie really about like what she's done wrong or could have done differently. You know, like he had to come to her. It was his issue that was stopping them from being together. Right. You know what I mean? Not her.
I feel like maybe what I was trying to say was that basically crazy rich Asians, like for, I think Constance Wu's character basically had to move out of her comfort zone in a big way. Whereupon in Always Be My Maybe, you see the opposite happening, which is Marcus having to do that. Whereupon in Sasha, because, you know, she already has a career established, she's, you know, she doesn't have to do as much. And, you know, it's like every relationship, obviously you kind of make compromises and everything, but it was, I think, just in terms of context of a, you know, just of a movie, you know, of a romantic comedy, it's actually really refreshing to see a guy kind of basically be like, I'm going to take this leap of faith for you. You know, I'm going to move out of my comfort zone because in this particular moment, I'm the one who needs to do that, you know? So I just thought that was like, I really appreciated that actually. You know, I think part of it's just like for me personally, because like, when I got engaged to, my husband was actually the reason I moved to Taipei. So like, which is, you know, was
built in bias there.
Yeah. Like have some built in frustration, resentment. No, I'm kidding. No, but I mean, yeah, it's a situation that definitely like, I mean, it worked out for us, but I feel like, you know, I've seen this repeat in a lot of other like kind of expat couples where it's always kind of like the woman kind of moving for a husband's job. Not even just expats, but like just in general, it's always like, you know, it's like, for example, when you have kids, when there's any other big stage in a relationship, it's always somehow like, it's often the woman who has to give up her job, who has to move, who has to, you know, X, Y, Z. It's any number of things where basically they're being asked to move out of their comfort zone.
Well, we're women,
Catherine. In a way that...
It's our cross to bear.
Yeah, exactly. It's our cross to bear. But it's really nice to see a movie where, you know, it's like Marcus not only kind of does that for Sasha, but it actually helps, it's actually to his benefit too. And he's happier for it. So, you know, I was actually thinking I would really love to see a sequel to this film because I kind of always see where their story goes. Because the thing is like, even though it is like a positive step for both of them, like how exactly is he going to like deal with like being in her, like, you know, her, her world.
Oh my God.
You know, when he wasn't always comfortable with that. I'm intrigued.
I would watch him being like a homemaker to their baby because she's like got to go. Yeah, run. Yeah. Like I would love that. That's some good shit right there. Yeah. If they so choose, not everybody has to have a baby. But
and I think also that what's great about that is that it's this very different part of the reason why I think so many traditional rom-coms have to sort of put the woman in that tradition is because in that position is because it's this idea of masculinity and that you can't have your male romantic lead not be proactive in some way, that to hold someone's purse the way Randall Park's character does is in some ways like emasculating. And I like that this is completely not concerned about that. Like that is like, yes, like that your correct position is to hold her fucking purse. And that is what you have to realize. And I think that is like both empowering to her, but also in a way like empowering to him to like say like, you don't have to be this sort of traditional kind of, you know, man, like you can, it's totally fine to just be the supportive guy. That's great. I think the one thing I didn't love about that I thought was less well developed in that area. Well, A, I wasn't crazy about the way they used the mother's death. That felt a little bit like they didn't quite have the time to deal with that. And it felt kind of like pulled.
Yeah.
Out of, like kind of just came back as a way to like add some weight to the ending. And I thought the other thing where she did have to learn was this idea of authenticity, which I should say, like I'd read this article in Eater that was about this as well, which I think had gotten me thinking about it. But this idea that she has to get comfortable with authentic food. And I think there is a potentially interesting story there that in some ways really resonates with me, where I felt like at first, because I didn't think of myself as a traditional Asian American, I felt like I had to completely reject that idea of myself and be like, oh, everything Asian American is bad. I'm just like, you know, I'm just an American.
Yeah, I feel like we had like really like similar experiences growing up, you and
right.
me.
And then as you become more mature, you sort of become comfortable with it and say, look, Asian American isn't all I am, but it's an integral part of my identity and I can be comfortable with that. And I feel like that would have been an interesting story, but like there's only a few scenes and it becomes so much about the idea of her embracing authentic Asian food and opening this restaurant that's just straight up representations of what, you know, his dead mom cooked. I thought it wasn't quite handled as well as it could have been.
Yeah, I kind of had the same feeling too, where, you know, I was just like, realistically, if you're going to open a restaurant that just serves kind of more straightforward, you know, Korean style home cooking in New York City, you're just going to have a lot of competition. You're just going to, it's just good. You know, like, I was watching, I was like, this is not very realistic, you know? But I was like, yeah, it's like Anthony, it's like, you know, it's like what you said really resonated with me because I had that same kind of went through that same thought process when I was growing up, which was for me in work to kind of establish my, you know, kind of to figure out what my identity was when I was in, you know, when I was a kid and into my early 20s, perhaps, was that I felt like I had to reject a lot of things that were Asian or Asian American. And, you know, that wasn't because I didn't want to be Asian American, but I felt like, I think, you know, in hindsight, it was more me rejecting what society thought being Asian American can be. And, you know, mm-hmm. I was like in that New York article, the interview with Randall Park, he says is like, I actually have it open in front of me. He says, what happens when you populate a movie with a lot of Asian American people is that they get to be people. And I was just like, wow. I mean, it's such a simple concept, but it kind of put into words what I have enjoyed seeing about Always Be, what I really liked about Always Be My Maybe is just like, you know, Asian Americans, you know, people of color, just people in general, just like talking about random things and Asian Americans just basically being able to be who they are with, you know, the quirks, like Marcus's friend, who's really upset that Marcus hasn't noticed that he lost 50 pounds and is now size medium. I just loved that so much because it was just like, you know, it's just such, it's a universe. It's like, it's very specific to his character, but it's also like a universal experience. And, you know, it's actually funny because the thing is, I was kind of chatting with my friend just about crazy rich Asians, you know, the evolution of kind of like representation Asian American films since the Joy Luck Club. And then crazy Harold and Kumar and Better Luck Tomorrow. I guess those were more like independent releases. So in terms of like major huge studio releases, you have this big gap between Joy Luck Club and then crazy rich Asians. And then now, like, always be my maybe. It's maybe in terms of, like, it's a Netflix film. So in terms of distribution, it maybe isn't as, like, quite as, like, intense as, like, a big studio film. But it still is, like,
and obviously. I think definitely they spent a lot more money on Crazy Rich Asians.
Yeah, definitely. But I think one of the things I was saying was just, like, I mean, I was joking around about it. I was just like, well, you know, now that there's more Asian American representation, there's just one more way for me to judge people based on their taste in pop culture, because Asian Americans don't all have to like the same things, because now we have more things, we have increasingly large amounts of things to choose from. So I'm going to start judging you, Anthony. I'm kidding. But no, it's just like, I think that was one of the things. It's like, where I think a lot of the power of these films is not necessarily wider, like whether or not they're like really great works of art. But I think it's just maybe the realization as an Asian American who also had a hard time kind of reconciling my individual identity with, like, you know, group identity, and not just group identity, but also what, like, the, you know, just America in general wanted Asian Americans to be. I think it's just so really, it's really meaningful just to see, like, the full spectrum of personalities and quirks and weirdness and experiences represented. You know, just like in, you know, for example, Marcus's girlfriend is, like, she's not the Asian girlfriend, or she's, like, she's just weird. She's, like, the weird, she's, like, the weird, slightly clueless, out of it girlfriend. And then, you know, Marcus and Sasha's respective, like, sets of parents, they're not, like, Asian parents. You know, they have very, very different relationships. And I feel like, to a certain extent, like, more with the Kims than with the trans, you kind of get to see their relationship with their children develop in a way that's kind of surprisingly nuanced for, like, a romantic comedy. I think it was like the conversation about around Crazy Rich Asians. And I think to a certain extent, Always Be My Maybe too, is that these films basically, they have a power beyond what the film actually is, if that makes any sense. I think, and also,
absolutely,
you know, emotionally, and also in terms of the fact that it's kind of created a cascading effect, especially with Crazy Rich Asians doing as well as it did, where we're going to see more stuff like this greenlit, and it's no longer going to be like, as they come out, it's no longer be like, oh, look, Asian American representations. It's going to be, you know, another film that comes out that could be judged on its own merits.
Right. And that it doesn't have to sort of take on the full weight of representing that experience. And so that you can be like, oh, I didn't like this one, or this part wasn't that great. And, you know, I think that, you know, that my friends and I sometimes have this sort of way shorthand where we talk about, is this a credit or debit for Asian Americans?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I think it's nice not to have to feel that, of like, to watch this movie and be like, sometimes, because in every other movie, right, there's only the one Asian American character. And so you immediately are like, oh no, is this like representing my whole experience well and accurately and all of that? And here, where there's just so many, even if some of them, I think, are some of the storylines and characters are better executed than others, I can be like, it's fine, because there's so many, just in the composite, there's so many different kinds of experience and people represented here that in and of itself, that's great.
Yeah, I think it's a real relief to just be able to basically maybe, I was just thinking, because I was actually been thinking about the Joylet Club a lot recently. For some reason, I don't know, maybe it's because I've been kidnapped, but I was just like, you know, I remember when it first came out, there was a huge discussion about what was problematic in it, if its depiction of like China and Chinese Americans was too like, or, you know, smack too much of I can't pronounce that.
Orientalism, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, it was too exoticized. But then, you know, it was one of the things I've been thinking about over the past week, is that it's just such a huge relief in a way. And I hadn't realized that it would be before, to be able to be like, oh, I didn't like it. Or actually, I like that film a lot. To be able to just express like a simple opinion about how you felt about a particular show or movie without it feeling like you're making a huge, big statement about, you know, being an Asian American or about other people's Asian American identities. You know what I'm trying to say? It's just like, it's just a relief just to be able to be like, yeah, that film was meh, or I really love that film, and, you know, not necessarily have it have to have have that statement have more import than you just basically expressing your opinion as an individual.
That is probably a good note to end on. Are there any final thoughts about Always Be My Maybe?
I really want to see a sequel, actually. Yeah. I think it'd be, I'm really interested to know how that particular relationship dynamic between the two of them works out.
I'm curious to see a sequel. I guess maybe I'm more interested in just seeing Ali Wong and Randall Park being in more movies, being the leads in more movies, writing more movies, and whether or not it's about these characters, I don't necessarily feel that strongly.
Yeah. Well, Randall Park, the thing, he's just so charismatic. Remember when they were looking for an Oscar host before they decided to just do away with the idea of having one host? Some people mentioned having him as one. I was just like, Randall Park, like, he's just, I don't know if it's just because I'm biased towards him, but I just feel like he has the whole package. Like, he's extremely charismatic. He's good looking. He's obviously, it's really amazing how he's able to play this like really awkward 17-year-old as effectively as he's able to play like, you know, a 37-year-old who's, or however old he is, who's kind of lost in life, as he is on Fresh Off the Boat, where he's
like
able
34, yeah.
Yeah, where he's able to portray like a father of three. I was just like, he is really convincing all of them. And it's just, yeah, it's like you said, it's just exciting to think that, you know, now we'll be able to see more things with Ali Wong or Randall Park, you know, either together or, you know, separately. I'm just excited to see more things come from them.
Yeah. Well, then let's wrap it up there. I will remind our listeners that if you have any feedback either about Always Be My Maybe or about the podcast, you can email us at originalcontent@techcrunch.com. We also appreciate people who subscribe or leave us reviews in Apple Podcasts or any other podcast app that you enjoy. And thank you for listening, Jordan and Catherine. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll